Times. Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi met yesterday with the Supreme Judicial Council a few days after he had decreed that any decisions he made were beyond judicial review. Morsi's actions led to large street demonstrations and a strike by judges and lawyers protesting Morsi's power grab. His spokesman seemed to walk back that sweeping authority, saying the president only wanted to protect the Constitutional Assembly and the writing of the country's new constitution. Protesters in Cairo clashed with police at Tahrir Square today, the site of the uprising almost 2 years ago that toppled Hosni Mubarak. We asked Eric Traeger to join us. He's Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute, where his research focuses on Egyptian opposition parties. In fact, he was in Egypt during the 2011 anti-Mubarak revolts. He's written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, the Atlantic, and the New Republic. And Eric, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good to be with you, Marty.
Would you say that Morsi blinked?
Well, I don't think he blinked, if you're referring to his meeting last night with the judges, where he, you know, clarified his constitutional declaration by saying that his power grab really only applied to certain types of presidential actions. But he clarified that verbally. There's no new constitutional declaration. There's nothing in writing. And he said that the power grab only applies to sovereign acts, which is itself a very vague idea. Not only that, he hasn't repealed the clause that gives him full authority to take any measure necessary for advancing the revolution. So I don't see any walk back, and the Brotherhood has signaled today that he won't walk back.
Where does that leave, then, the Supreme Judicial Council that met with Morsi yesterday?
Well, it's really not clear whether they're satisfied by his verbal assurances. My guess is that they're not, because one of the things that he's standing by is his call to insulate the Constitution Writing Assembly from any sort of judicial oversight. Now, the Constitution Writing Assembly is not only Islamist-dominated. All non-Islamists have left it, including all female members. And that was going to be a possible reason for its dissolution when the court heard a case regarding the Constitutional Assembly later this month. So he's still effectively restricted their powers.
Let me quote something from the New York Times, an editorial today, about what we are talking about, Eric. And one of the things that they say is several months ago, the Mubarak-appointed courts dissolved the democratically elected Islamist-led lower house of parliament and the first constitutional drafting committee. Do the courts bear some responsibility in this crisis?
Well, I think there's no question that, you know, these courts contain people who are holdovers from the Mubarak regime, and that on some level what's going on here is a continuation of the power struggle between the Muslim Brotherhood, which is kind of the new ruling party in Egypt, and the old ruling party, or people who were appointed by Mubarak. Nonetheless, the dissolution of parliament in June was not unprecedented. This had happened in 1987, in 1990, for similar reasons having to do with the way in which the election was held. And then there was this question of whether a parliament that had been dissolved could appoint a constitutional assembly, or whether that would also have to be dissolved. So look, there's no question that, you know, there's this ongoing struggle between the Brotherhood and the courts, you know, whose judges have been appointed by Mubarak. But, you know, the courts historically have been relatively independent. And I really emphasize relatively here. We're still talking about autocratic institutions, but, you know, well-respected institutions that occasionally disagreed with the old regime. And by removing them, Morsi is removing the one possible check on his authority.
How do you then understand the protests? They happened very shortly after Morsi made this decree. There were some signs that said Morsi is Mubarak at some of the protests. There were protests or props even today in Cairo.
Well, you know, there has been opposition mounting to Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood for some time. We should remember that in the second round of the presidential election, Morsi ran against Mubarak's last prime minister, Ahmed Shafiq. Shafiq, despite being Mubarak's last prime minister, got 48.2% of the vote. So this was a close election in which non-Islamists, including many supporters of the old regime, showed that they could mobilize and they actually had a fairly decent popular support. I think that the protests today are a product of that, but we shouldn't work under the illusion that these protests might go the way of, let's say, the January 2011 protest that ousted Mubarak, or in that it'll force Morsi to make concessions. Because the difference between the Muslim Brotherhood and the old ruling party is that the Muslim Brotherhood is actually able to mobilize people in a very efficient way. Muslim Brothers, are recruited into the organization through a 5 to 8 year process. They're effectively foot soldiers who have been vetted for their commitment to the organization. And the Brotherhood can dispatch them nationwide to have their own protest to support Morsi. Now, they've decided not to do so today because they're afraid of violent conflict. I suspect they're also working under the assumption that more protests might turn off the broader Egyptian public that really wants things to return to calm and normal. But the Brotherhood can respond very effectively with its own protest to these protests, so I think this battle is going to continue for a while.
Was Mohamed Morsi, though, fairly elected president of Egypt?
No question he was fairly elected. I mean, you know, the Carter Center monitored the elections. They put out a report that said that it wasn't a perfect election, that the Muslim Brotherhood used its social services networks as some sort of vote-buying mechanism, but that they judged that it hadn't had any effect on the outcome of the elections. And frankly, having been in Egypt quite a lot over the last 2 years, including in the week leading up to the announcement of the elections, actually not during the elections itself, I suspect that's right. I mean, I think that the Muslim Brotherhood really did and does have substantial public support in Egypt. It really can mobilize its people. I mean, this is a religious country that is likely to vote for a religious party. So I don't think that, you know, Morsi's presidency is illegitimate. What's illegitimate, in my view, is his power grab. And I think it's a sign of things to come. It's a sign of the very anti-democratic organization that he comes from that still may use, you know, elections and formal democratic procedures as a conduit to power. But, you know, they don't see those things as sacred necessarily.
Would it be fair to say, though, that we are seeing some growing pains in Egypt, the growing pains of a relatively new, relatively democratic country?
Well, I mean, one would like to think that. One would like to think that Egypt is moving in a democratic direction. But, you know, the fact that you have one party, really the Muslim Brotherhood, that is so much better organized and so much better prepared to seize the momentum than anyone else, and that party really is aiming for something that is quite undemocratic, something that is quite theocratic, an Islamic state under their domination, will allow them to prevent the emergence of a democratic polity in Egypt. And frankly, I think that's why Morsi's power grab is so concerning, because this is not somebody who is doing the kinds of things that you would expect if Egypt was just going through growing pains. He's not cooperating with the opposition. He's not compromising in any way. He's not really having dialogue with other governmental institutions. His decisions are the product of the inner circle of the Muslim Brotherhood. And that's why it's going to be the Muslim Brotherhood that's defending him. I'm not saying that won't work. I'm just pointing out that the way in which he's going about asserting his power is something that will push democracy backwards rather than push it forwards. And I just think we should be aware that, you know, history can move in two directions. The fact that Egypt toppled a dictator does not in and of itself mean that it will become democratic. There are many other directions it can move, and the Brotherhood is steering it in not only a theocratic direction by trying to establish an Islamic state, but now a very autocratic direction.
But are you then concerned about the rights of minorities, the rights of women, the freedom of the press, the freedom of assembly, those things that we think of as hallmarks of a democracy?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, first of all, we should note that all of the women who were on the Constituent Assembly, that's the Constitution Writing Body, have left. The last one left yesterday. Secondly, if we look at the way the Brotherhood has dealt with the media, and this is really preceding the current episode, it's been very, very negative. So in addition to, of course, firing top generals and declaring full legislative power in August, Morsi fired all state editors of the state-run newspapers and appointed Muslim Brothers in his place, in their place, including the editor of the most published daily, who has a real record of being quite anti-Christian as well as very anti-Baha'i. Now, Christians are particularly worried about their future in Egypt, which is why there are all sorts of reports of Christians trying to leave Egypt. It's worth noting that Morsi did not attend the inauguration of the new pope, and that really should be taken as a signal of where things are moving. I mean, the Brotherhood is not a tolerant organization, and they're moving very swiftly to control the state media, which is ironic because when they were in the opposition, of course, they very much opposed the state media and even indicated that they might try to get rid of it.
What happened to the Arab Spring, which, of course, began in Tahrir Square in Cairo?
Well, you know, what happened is that the young people, the telegenic, inspiring young people, many of whom I know, by the way, so I really do believe that they are quite inspiring. The problem, though, is that they weren't unified around anything other than opposition to Mubarak. Mubarak was the one thing that brought liberals, leftists, socialists, communists, quasi-Islamists, real Islamists together, and that is why last year's revolution was so successful. But once Mubarak was gone, these young people had massive disagreements with each other because of just how disparate their political views were, whereas the Brotherhood really represented and stood for one thing, and not only was cohesive in its views, but was cohesive in how it could move people, because, again, this is an organization that takes 5 to 8 years to join, and during that period of joining it, its members are vetted for their commitment to the cause. Not only that, its members are stationed around the country in what are known as cells or families, the Brotherhood's central leadership is able to move these cells in a very efficient way. So they're organized, they stand for a unified ideology, and with all these other disparate, disorganized groups in the wake of Mubarak's fall, only the Brotherhood really had what it took to seize the momentum, win elections, and then put its vision for Egypt into action.
We have about a minute before our first break here, but is the vision for the Muslim Brotherhood a country like Iran? Government?
They would, of course, say no because of their own opposition to Shiism. But I think it's different in the sense that there's really no charismatic leader for the Brotherhood in the way that there is for Iran. And not only that, in Iran, of course, the leader has established himself as the lone jurisprudent of the Sharia, the lone person responsible for interpreting the Sharia. The Brotherhood really, uses the phrase Islamic State sort of vaguely, is much more interested in power than in any sort of specific religious vision.
And that's Eric Traeger, our first of two guests in this hour of Radio Times. So we're talking in the first half of the show about the crisis in Egypt, and he's a Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute, has done extensive research on Egyptian opposition parties, was in Egypt during the Arab uprising in 2011, has written a number of articles for a number of publications. And any questions or comments that you might have, do give us a call, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
WHYY is supported by the Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, managing severe orthopedic injury and joint disease. Their team of fellowship-trained and board-certified joint replacement surgeons, rheumatologists, and physical therapists are committed to using an advanced approach to joint care, individualized for each patient. Cooper Bone and Joint Institute, with locations in South Jersey and Newtown Square. More at cooperhealth.org/ortho or 800-8-COOPER.
Adult classes are forming now for the WHYY Hamilton Commons. Learn about editing digital video and audio, as well as crafting your own documentary. Classes for editing on Final Cut Pro begin December 10th. On January 9th, enter the world of audio storytelling. And on January 12th, a four-week class will help you craft your own documentary. For more information and a full course listing, visit whyy.org/Hamilton Commons.
Next time in Studio 360, faking photographs during the century and a half before Photoshop.
And they usually would say, well, this is very interesting, but this is not photography. And I think, I buy everything at the camera store. I spend long hours in the darkroom. What are we going to call it?
Plus, the Canadian band Cold Specs. That's next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking about the fact that last week Egypt's President Morsi sparked demonstrations and protests when he announced that his decisions would be exempt from judicial review. This was right after he had helped to negotiate a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza, which earned him high praise. We're talking with the Washington Institute's Eric Traeger about Morsi and Egypt and taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Eric, was there some timing or coincidence after Morsi had frankly gotten a lot of praise for his assistance in this ceasefire? No sooner had he done that than he does this power grab. What's the connection between the two, do you think?
I mean, I definitely think that people in Washington and in the U.S. are seeing that connection. But in fact, my guess is that this constitutional declaration, this power grab, is something that had been in the works for a long time. I don't believe for a second that someone just woke up and said, all right, well, we have, goodwill from the United States. Let's do this now. And there are good reasons to believe that this was in the works, because Morsi sees himself confronting a number of threats. First of all, he was worried about the dissolution of the Constituent Assembly, which is writing the new constitution. So he wants to insulate it from dissolution so that it could continue its work of trying to establish an Islamic state in Egypt. Secondly, he was probably worried about the forthcoming elections, that the old ruling party might pose the greatest threat to the Brotherhood in those parliamentary elections. So this declaration definitely gives him the ability to hit at the old ruling party. And third, he was in the process of negotiating a loan with the IMF that would have required Egypt to undertake some significant neoliberal reforms, and that probably would have sparked protests. So this declaration presumably gives him the authority to use a heavy hand against that. So I think there are many domestic factors that probably contributed to him feeling that he needed more power that really have nothing to do with the international context.
Is there pressure on President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood because the economy in Egypt is in such bad shape, and also the jobless rate is high even by Egypt standards?
There's tremendous pressure on him. I mean, people feel that their lives have not improved since the revolution. The economy is suffering a great deal, which is, of course, why the Brotherhood is pursuing an IMF loan, despite the fact that the loan will require interest, which of course is against Islamic law. Mm. So no question about that. The problem, though, is that the response to the power grab, these mass protests, have taken a significant toll on the Egyptian stock market, which lost about $5 billion this week. So one of the reasons he might want to resolve the crisis, hopefully through compromise and not through repression, will be because the longer these continue, the worse Egypt's economy.
Let me get, looks like Randy from Bluebell to join our conversation. And Randy, go ahead. You're on the air. Go ahead,
Hello.
Randy. Hi. Go ahead.
My question is, isn't there a collective American foreign policy naivete regarding the Arab Spring and Egypt in particular, regarding it's not being a democratic movement, but much more of a Muslim Brotherhood ideological struggle of dominance as opposed to freeing the populace from Mubarak?
Well, Randy, I agree with you completely that the optimism about the Arab Spring really prevented people from taking a close look at the kinds of forces that were quickly emerging to fill the void that these autocratic rulers had left. So I completely agree with you there. On the other hand, I think it should be allowed, so to speak, for us to have been impressed by the outpouring of pro-democratic sentiments during last year's protests. And having been in the protests myself, having covered them in Tahrir Square, I can tell you that this really was a pro-democratic movement of very hopeful, yes, and optimistic young people. But that is, quite separate from the kinds of forces that were prepared to seize the momentum, which, you're completely correct, were very undemocratic.
Randy, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. Eric, though, the Muslim Brotherhood doesn't control the military, at least not yet, or the Ministry of Interior.
That's true. With the military, though, it seems that President Morsi has achieved some kind of deal, and that the terms of that deal seems to be that Morsi is, you know, the head of state as he was elected to be, that he is in full political control, so the military takes no political stands anymore. But in exchange, you know, he will not, for the moment at least, touch things that are important to the military, such as its perquisites, you know, such as its aid from the United States, and by extension, perhaps the peace treaty with Israel. We see evidence of this deal in the new constitution draft, which gives the military extensive and, might I say, very undemocratic authorities. Mm-hmm. We see this in the extent to which he's appointed ex-generals to be governors. Now, as for the Interior Ministry, well, it's true that the Muslim Brotherhood, you know, probably has not penetrated the ministry just yet. It's interesting that one of the key demands of last year's revolution was reforming the Interior Ministry, but Morsi hasn't taken any moves at all to implement that. If anything, the Interior Ministry is right now supporting Morsi and cracking down on these protests very, very hardly, including using birdshot that, according to reports, is not even rubberized. So people are being shot by metal pellets, according to you know, things that I've been reading. So the Interior Ministry, while not really a brotherhood organization, is you know, cracking down on behalf of a brotherhood president, much in the same way that it did for Mubarak.
What have you been reading?
Well, what I've been following Twitter feeds. I've been reading the Egyptian press, Al-Masr al-Yom, Al-Ahram, the Brotherhood's website. I'm reading accounts of both protesters and the Muslim Brothers. And it seems pretty clear that the Interior Ministry here is not acting independently of the president.
The United States gives Egypt a lot of money in foreign aid. Does the U.S. have influence or clout in that country under President Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood?
Well, you know, the U.S. has as much influence as it's willing to use. Right now, the approach of many in Washington has been to see our aid as kind of charity, as something that we give in the hopes that it will make Egypt and make President Morsi and make the Brotherhood like us. But the fact is that aid, in my view at least, is not charity. It's an investment. It's an investment in a certain type of Egypt, an Egypt that's at peace with its neighbors, an Egypt that promotes pluralism at home. And we can use that aid as leverage by simply saying that we're going to withhold it, that we're not going to invest in an Egypt that cracks down on its people, that is run by another dictator. Look, the United States invested in Egyptian dictatorship for about 35 years. And I don't think that we should be going down that road anymore, especially when we see what the response is in Cairo and the extent to which that is not only domestically destabilizing, but very damaging to Egypt's economy.
Do you think Morsi wants to be the dictator of Egypt?
Certainly, he's given every indication that's how he intends to rule. I mean, this is, we should remember, the second power grab that he has pulled off. And it's also important to see the way in which he's characterizing his opponents. He's not, you know, respecting them at all. He's calling them weevils who are eating away at the nation. The Muslim Brotherhood is characterizing them as un-Islamic, saying that they didn't pray on Friday, saying that they're apostates. So you know, there's a real delegitimation of his opponents that is quite undemocratic and really, I think, speaks to his undemocratic intentions.
You describe, and others have described, the Muslim Brotherhood as being organized, and that's one of the ways that they came to power. Looking at their opponents, is there any desire or even ability to similarly organize?
Well, it's going to be difficult because it's not just that the Brotherhood is organized like a normal political party. I mean, it's really organized like a militia. It has ranks. It has a whole process through which one becomes a Muslim Brother. It has a nationwide structure with different administrative tiers that allows it to move people, kind of like the way a militia would move divisions. Now, I don't use the word militia to imply that they're violent necessarily. I'm using that word simply to describe the way it's organized. And it's hard, really, for non-Islamists, for liberals, for leftists, to really create a militia-like structure. I mean, that really requires significant ideological buy-in from the members, and that simply doesn't exist in Egypt beyond the Muslim Brotherhood.
Do you worry about this country?
I worry about it tremendously. I, of course, have, you know, many friends there. I've spent a lot of time there, and the prospect of another Egyptian dictator who is now quite theocratic in his intentions, I can tell you, is definitely not what many of my Egyptian friends thought they were signing up for when they took to the square last year.
Well, Eric Traeger, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me, Mark.
You're welcome. Next Generation Fellow at the Washington Institute. His research focuses on Egyptian opposition parties. He's written for a number of publications, including the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, Foreign Affairs, The Atlantic, and The New Republic. Well, the conflict in Syria began almost 2 years ago in March 2011 to protest the brutal regime of Bashar al-Assad. The violence and fighting have become a civil war, which has killed an estimated 40,000 people and forced millions from their home. It's threatening to destabilize the region, with Turkey and Syria exchanging mortar fire. We asked Professor Morhaf Shwejati to join us to help us sort things out about what is happening in Syria and what it all means. He is a Syrian-born specialist in Middle East affairs, served on the Syrian National Council, an opposition coalition led by Syrians living abroad. He's a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. And Professor Shwejati, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're very welcome. I want to quote something that I read this morning from the Daily Star in Lebanon. This is the first paragraph. President Bashar al-Assad is increasingly relying on militiamen and members of the Alawite community to defend his regime as rebels advance in Syria's north and east and inevitably towards a final showdown in Damascus, analysts say. Does that square with what you are understanding about what's happening inside of Syria today?
Absolutely. President Assad has moved slowly, I must say, but has moved from being a president of a sovereign state to the chief of a militia. As you know, the population of Syria is a mosaic. It is divided along sectarian lines. And he represents the minority Alawites who are in control of the Syrian government. And they are his last supporters. So, in fact, he is a militia leader. He is fighting for the survival of the regime. And the longer this continues, the more evident it becomes that his regime is collapsing.
Well, what we read is that it's at least it has been well armed, but also dealing with the problem of defections from the military. Again, is that true?
Absolutely. The defections started, of course, when soldiers were asked by their superiors to shoot at unarmed civilian protesters who were marching in demonstrations. And pretty soon, these defections began to multiply, function of the increasing brutality of the regime against the civilian population, so much so that now in the ranks of what is called the Free Syria Army, there are tens of thousands of defected soldiers and officers who are putting up a fight against the Assad regime.
I was reading about the fact that it looks like 10 children who were playing outside in a village east of Damascus were killed. The possibility of the use of cluster bombs, I know that Human Rights Watch has reported and alleged that Syria has used cluster bombs. A very sad story to read, I must say.
Evidence of the brutality of the regime. This would not have been the first time that the regime uses cluster bombs, which is internationally prohibited, against its own civilian population. What happened yesterday was, again, regime shelling of a park in which kids play. This park was bombed with cluster bombs, killing 10 children. So, again, it goes to show the brutality of the regime and the fact that it is so desperate that it is using these things against its civilian population.
But do you see a showdown in Damascus between the Syrian military and the rebel forces?
Absolutely. It's going to come down to this. The last battle before the collapse of the regime is going to have to take place in Damascus, the capital. The fear is that the regime now, which has lost quite a lot and is going to, in the end, lose its life, is going to cause massive destruction to the city of Damascus, a very historic city.
I'm reading a quote from Bashar al-Assad. He said, "I'm not a puppet. I was not made by the West to go to the West or any other country. I'm a Syrian. I was made in Syria. I have to live in Syria and die in Syria." And it sounds as if he will not in any way relent or give up.
He has chosen the path of the late Muammar Gaddafi of Libya. He has been given several opportunities to go abroad, to live in exile, to relent. But no, he prefers to die in Syria, and things look like his wish is going to come true. He is going to come down, I believe, just like Muammar Gaddafi did towards the end of the Libyan revolution.
Meaning that he's going to lose.
He is not only going to lose, but again, I think he is in this fight to the death, to his death.
And taking his country with him?
And taking his country with him. This is the mindset of an authoritarian regime, that although the regime knows it is collapsing, it's going to bring down the country with it, only to show those who resist who was really boss.
I was reading, and I want to just check with you about the rebel fighters, as they are called. They're both, I guess, organized and disorganized. But there are reports that there are some al-Qaeda-linked groups, including one called Jabhat al-Nusra, who are part of the rebels fighting the regime of Assad.
The initially, of course, the Free Syrian Army is a very secular army. You are right. They were very divided. There was a brigade here and a battalion here and a unit there. There is increasing unity among them. But in the process, there has been the infiltration of jihadists, mostly from Iraq, coming from Iraq, in order also to fight the Assad regime. Now, these jihadists are a cause of concern for what is a secular revolution, but I have to say that their numbers are still minor. Overall, the fighters against the rebels, against the Assad regime, are for the most part secularists, but again, you are right. There is the infiltration of jihadists, and this Jabhat al-Nusra is an affiliate, apparently, of al-Qaeda.
And we're almost up on a break here, but why would jihadis from Iraq want to go to Syria to fight?
Jihadis try to find vacuums of power wherever they can, so they can be there. This is part and parcel of their ideological fight. They want the establishment of an Islamic State, whether that is in Syria or in the Arabian Peninsula or in the Maghreb. And here there are many vacuums of power in Syria as a result of the fighting between the Assad regime and the rebels. So it is only natural for them to try to fill in these voids in order to increase their power.
Well, let's take that short break. We will get back to our conversation with Murhaf Shwejati, and he's a Syrian-born specialist in Middle East affairs. He served for a time on the Syrian National Council. He's a professor of Middle East Studies at the National Defense University's Near East South Asia Center for Strategic Studies. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. Call us. We'll be right back.
AM 1112 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. Now on stage, Dave and Aaron Go to Work. Created and performed by Barrymore Award-winning Philadelphia artists Dave Jotico and Aaron Cromie. Dave and Aaron Go to Work harkens back to the days of Laurel and Hardy, Charlie Chaplin, and Buster Keaton in a wordless comedy for all ages. Tickets for Dave and Aaron Go to Work are available now at 215-592-9560 or at 1812productions.org.
On the next Fresh Air, Yemen, Al-Qaeda, and America's War in Arabia. We talk with Gregory Johnson about his new book, The Last Refuge. It explains the rise, fall, and resurrection of Al-Qaeda in Yemen, which continues to plot attacks against the U.S. Johnson is a former Fulbright Fellow in Yemen and works in the Near Eastern Studies Department at Princeton University. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. A top neurosurgeon says he has proof that heaven exists. He was there. We'll hear his story. Also, Alexander McCall Smith on his latest philosophical mystery. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoe. We're talking about Syria, where civil war has raged on for many months now. Tens of thousands have been killed and several million have been displaced. And again, our guest is Murhaf Shwejati, and he's from the National Defense University in Washington, D.C. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You served for some time on the Syrian National Council. First of all, why did you want to serve on the council? And then I know you left. Why did you leave?
I am opposed to the Assad regime because it is an authoritarian dictatorial regime that has been in place for the past 42 years, denying the basic human rights of Syrian citizens, let alone the imprisonment and the torture and the physical abuse and so on. The uprising in Syria, I believe, is part and parcel of the Arab Spring, in which many Arab peoples have risen against their own dictatorships. And so I joined the SNC in support of the freedom and democracy that Syrians seek. I left the SNC because it was an organization that was not as disciplined as I would like, nor as organized hierarchically as is required of an opposition movement that wants to bring down a dictatorial regime. There was a lot of infighting, and it was dominated by religious groups. And so in the end, I resigned from the SNC. Now, the good news is that the SNC has restructured itself and has become embedded within a larger opposition movement, which is the Syrian National Coalition, which includes now far more groups from the inside of Syria, and which is therefore much more representative of the Syrian people.
And this was a group that I guess was formed and met in Doha. Interestingly, it's been supported or endorsed by France, by Britain, by the EU. Is that significant?
That is very significant, to the point that France recognizes it as a government in exile and has received a Syrian ambassador from this opposition movement. The same is true of Britain. The Gulf Cooperation Council has recognized it. The EU has recognized it. And the United States supports it, albeit not to the same level as France and Britain.
Do you think the U.S. should support it?
I certainly do. Again, this is a democratic opposition, which is representative of the Syrian people, who are calling for freedom and democracy, which are really the core values of Americans. And so I certainly think they should. The United States should do more in the support of the Syrian opposition.
But what can a government in exile do in a country or with a country like Syria?
Well, a government in exile would be in a position to channel all the assistance coming from the outside, whether this assistance is financial, whether it is military, and by channeling it, it would unite all the opposition and make it more effective in its resistance against the regime.
Are you concerned, going back even to the Free Syrian Army, that if there are terrorists who have infiltrated, that they could get then their hands on some of these military weapons that might be sent by supporters of the Syrian National Coalition?
Well, look, several things. The military support that has taken place to the Free Syrian Army has consisted, for the most part, in machine guns. And so this is not a danger. The Free Syrian Army is getting increasingly its weapons from weapons captured from the regime itself. Number two, these jihadists, I do not think, have the kind of political and cultural environment in which they can flourish and dominate. Syria has always been moderate in its Islam, and really there is no room, if any, very little room, if any, for extremism in Syria. So there are those extremists that are in the ranks of the Free Syrian Army, but in by no way would they be accepted or acceptable to the to the people at large.
The Assad regime is supported by Russia, supported by Iran, Hezbollah in Lebanon. Do you think these countries that support the Syrian National Coalition can exert more pressure on these countries?
They should, and they should assist more the opposition. Because let me tell you that without Russian support and Iranian support, the Assad regime would have collapsed long ago. Mm. And that would have saved literally thousands of lives. And the Assad regime survives today as a result of Russian support, whether it is in money or in military equipment, and Iranian support also in money and equipment, and Hezbollah in terms of manpower. And this support to the regime has been by far larger than any support that democratic countries have provided to the democratic mm-hmm. opposition.
And that's Murhaf Jouejati, and he joins us to talk about what's going on inside of Syria, a civil war raising a whole host of questions about the fighting in that country, what it means for the region. And he is with the National Defense University. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Why do you think Israel and Gaza was able to, or outsiders were able to negotiate a ceasefire between Gaza and Israel, but we haven't seen a ceasefire in Syria?
Israel and Gaza are two entities that have been in a conflict for a long time. This case is different in that it is an internal conflict. It is a conflict between a state and its society. The state has not arisen democratically. It has been monopolized by a family with its cronies and friends, and this family simply does not want to relinquish power. Bashar al-Assad and his family are of the view that Syria is their family farm and that the Syrian people are their cattle. So the difference between Israel and Gaza on the one hand and Syria on the other is that Israel and Gaza is an international conflict, whereas in Syria it is a domestic one.
And what is your vision for a post-Assad Syria?
I am confident, I am optimistic as to the future of Syria. It looks to me that the Syrian people have truly had it with now almost 50 years of dictatorship, 42 of those years of Assad rule. They are looking to be free, and they recognize the plurality of their society. That is a good omen for the future. At the economic level, Syrians have historically been entrepreneurs, and I think they would look forward to the reconstruction of their country, a country whose infrastructure has been devastated by the past 20 months of warfare. But I am optimistic that slowly Syria is going to come back to life and is going to be at least a regional mm-hmm. leader.
Before we began talking with you, we were talking about Egypt, of course. That was where the Arab Spring was born. And now we've got a government, certainly in the last couple of days, we've got a president, Morsi, who has essentially tried to grab power. Are you concerned that Syria could follow that similar model, or are there things that might prevent that?
Well, look, what happened in Egypt is scary to the minorities in Syria who are probably going to be more prudent. But on the other hand, it is a lesson learned. And now the Syrian people know that their leader should not have or should not be able to be in a position to have unchecked authority. There are lessons learned from Libya. There are lessons learned from Iraq. And so the more the Syrian people are seeing what is going on around them including events in Egypt, are lessons learned and things to be avoided following the collapse of the Assad regime.
Something like 40,000 people have been killed over the last almost 2 years of fighting in Syria. Is that correct?
It is now over 40,000 people. There are over 400,000 refugees outside of Syria. There are over 2 million internally displaced. Now, we are talking about over 10% of the population. If we were to provide some imagery to the American people of what that would mean in the United States, it is something like 30 million Americans being internally displaced.
And we're also talking about winter, the cold weather arriving, wondering about these refugee camps. I know the UN has been trying to reach everybody, but they haven't gotten to all of those who are displaced.
That's right. Most of these refugees were made to be refugees in the spring and later in the summer. Now winter is hitting the Middle East. It is getting very, very cold, and they simply do not have the equipment to cope with this. There are international relief agencies trying to help, but of course this is a catastrophe of huge proportions, and not enough is going in there.
Why do you think that is?
Bottlenecks, bureaucracies, hesitation on the parts of governments. It's a very problematic situation. The refugees of Syria are not only in one place that you could go help them. They are in several locations in the south of Turkey. They are in different locations in Lebanon. They are in different locations in Jordan and some in Iraq. So again, they are distributed throughout the all around the borders of Syria, making it even more difficult to channel relief to one place.
Well, and I know it's been difficult for reporters to get inside of Syria. Would that be true for humanitarian workers as well?
Humanitarian workers would not be allowed in Syria by the Assad regime. They are, of course, free to go in those areas that are liberated. The same goes for journalists. The Assad regime does not want foreign journalists to go in and document the reality of the brutality of that regime. But journalists have gone and are going into the liberated areas to see for themselves the events on the ground.
And how are the Syrian people, in a sense, either living or surviving under these difficult conditions?
Again, 2 million displaced. There are those that do not have enough financial resources to be able to travel abroad. They are stuck inside. What they do is to try to flee to neighboring villages where there are no bombings, fleeing back and forth and so on. It's a very difficult situation. The regime, for example, is cutting off power to those towns and cities that are rebellious. They are cutting off drinking water. There are many cities now where there is a siege around them. The city of Homs, which has a population of over 1.5 million, is under siege. There is no food going in. So truly the conditions are desperate.
Are you concerned about the destabilization of the region? And we hear about fighting, cross-border fighting between Turkey and Syria.
This is one of the instruments that Assad is using, is to try to scare the international community with a spillover of the fighting from Syria onto its neighbors. And we have seen the Assad regime foment trouble in Lebanon, and there has been firefights in Lebanon as a result. We have seen the Syrian army and air force even shell inside Turkey, which has prompted Turkey to respond in kind. The same is true of Israel. So again, this is a favored tactic of the Assad regime to tell the world, if you intervene, I'm going to bring down the entire Middle East.
Is this a Shiite Sunni conflict that's being played out in Syria? Is that one way to understand it?
This would be far too simple, I think, of an explanation. Again, this is part and parcel of the Arab Spring. you know, the people of Tunisia revolted against their dictatorship, although there is no Sunni-Shi'i rivalry there. The same is true of Egypt. The same is true of Yemen. And I think the same is true of Syria. This is a popular uprising against an authoritarian regime. Where it does get more complicated is that this regime happens to be sectarian, and the majority of Syrians happen to be from another sect. And so there are sectarian colorations to this conflict, but this is not a sectarian conflict. Again, this is an uprising of a people who want to be free.
I know that you left Syria. Do you, if things do settle down and there's a kind of much more democratic government, would you return to that country where you were born?
In a heartbeat.
Would you?
In a heartbeat. I would go down and do as best as I can, contribute as much as I can to the reconstruction of the country, but then I would return to the United States, which I have made my home.
You have family in Syria?
I have family in Syria, and I have lost some relatives in the fighting, but I am along with so many other Syrians. Mm-hmm. Imagine 40,000 civilians that have been killed.
I'm sorry to hear that about your family. These were people caught in the crossfire, or...?
Actually not. They were shot by regime snipers, shot to the head.
And where were they?
They were in Damascus. They were in Damascus, and there are areas in Damascus where the regime is so nervous that they shoot at anything that moves.
Well, I'm sorry to end our conversation on that sad note, but I thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Morhav Jouejati joining us, talking about the conflict, the civil war in Syria. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about this program. I'm Marty Moscoe, and thank you so much for joining us in this first hour. Stay with us, though. We'll be right back. Coming up, shifting gears as we always